This is I Choose Life News and Views, sponsored by Indiana Right to Life and Allen County Right to Life, committed to defending innocent human life for all people of all ages. Your hosts are Kathy Humbarger, Abigail Eschelbach, and Scott Kump.
Welcome to I Choose Life News and Views. I'm Kathy Humbarger.
I'm Abigail Eschelbach.
And I'm Scott Kump. I Choose Life News and Views is a joint project of Allen County Right to Life, Indiana Right to Life, and Bot Radio Network in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Today, we have a guest that I personally have been very interested in talking to, and we finally got it scheduled, and it is Ryan Bomberger of the Radiance Foundation. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Abigail. I'm glad I get to have a conversation with you.
Yeah, we've had some encounters, but never really gotten, I don't think, to actually sit down and chat. And especially you have this new book out, Not Equal, Civil Rights Gone Wrong. And so I'm very interested in letting our listeners know about that and having them check that out.
You know, it's great that, I mean, we've been able to connect in D.C. on college campuses and things. But, yeah, there's a lot of stuff to kind of get across with Not Equal and all this other substance. So I'm looking forward to it.
Can you give our listeners just a little bit of your background?
Yes, I am completely biased on this issue.
Good.
You know, I'm an adoptee and an adoptive father. And because of the incredible courage of my birth mom, she who chose life despite the horror of being raped, I'm actually here. I'm alive because of her courage. I'm also here and have been able to achieve the things throughout my life because of the love of two phenomenal parents who adopted me, who adopted nine other of my siblings and had 13 kids total. So that's my background, growing up in a very multiracial Christian home with two parents who just shattered that whole myth of the unwanted child.
Fantastic. And so I don't know actually much about your sort of middle history there before you founded the Radiance Foundation. Can you give us a little bit about your history sort of coming into the pro-life movement formally before you came to the Radiance Foundation?
Sure. In fact, it wasn't until I received my master's. I wanted to actually find my biological mother, and I didn't want to do it until I had received my master's degree. It was just something, a personal achievement thing for me. And although I got my master's degree at Regent University and was always an adoption advocate, had been involved in speaking at adoption-related events, foster care events, but wasn't formally involved in the pro-life movement, per se. But unfortunately, I wasn't able to find my biological mother. They weren't able to locate her, so we conducted the search. So that didn't happen. To this day, I've not ever connected with her, and all I really want to say to her, you know, these words aren't even sufficient, but I want to say thank you in the strongest way possible, but I'm going to wait for that opportunity. But it wasn't until I got married, my best friend and also the co-founder of the Radiance Foundation, Bethany, where back in 2009, we wanted to do more on some critical issues, particularly abortion, and talk about adoption and then family deterioration, fatherlessness, and things of those issues. So my wife, who's an educator, and with my background as a creative director working for ad agencies for years and years, creating campaigns that, you know, I could have cared less about because
right,
they didn't have eternal import. But we really wanted to do more. So we started this back in 2009. And this was kind of the culmination of years of already raising money for pregnancy care centers, years of already working with people within the movement, but still kind of being on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
So 2009 was really when we had started that. So it took our marriage and took our passion kind of fueled together to launch this endeavor.
Yeah. And for a lot of people, there's sort of that one defining moment. And you talked about sort of how it all culminated. Was there a one defining moment for you?
Actually, the defining moment happened years before, and that was actually at the commissioning service. So when, you know, for my master's degree at Regent, and I decided to share my story with the audience during that service of why it was so important that I got my master's degree. And I shared my background. I shared the brokenness that led to my adoption and all the restoration and the things that had happened since that point. And I remember people just crying in the audience. And, of course, I'm an emotional person, too. So I was crying. They were crying. There was a lot of ugly crying. And it was fine because I realized at that moment, in a way that I hadn't realized strongly before, that I have a story to tell. And I had so many people come up to me who told me, oh my gosh, you really need to share the story. This story needs to be public. And I realized, you know, just the power of a testimony but I didn't know how that would actually play out. It actually took years later, as I, you know, explained, but it really was that moment that I understood that God had given me a phenomenal story, and I needed to figure out ways with the abilities that he had given me to tell it.
And that marketing, especially, I mean, I know I see all your memes, and then throughout your book, it's fantastic. You talk about wanting to see books with pictures in it, you know, it makes it easier for them to be read.
Right.
And your book has tons of pictures in it. I love it. It's all these different sort of ads and memes and things that you've created that really do a fantastic job of portraying truths and cutting through all the verbiage and things that are put out there by pro-abortion advocates or just by liberal media or people trying to cover up certain truths. So really, yeah, your communications background does a wonderful job of that.
Thank you. I mean, I consider these things divine downloads. I mean, I love design, but honestly, I can't credit it to anything other than God just speaking words into me or just breathing words and life through these design skills that he's given me. And I love it because sometimes it just takes just a handful of words to recast something in somebody's mind. You could have heard it a million times some other way, but just a few words just tweaked change a person's perception or trigger something within them. And that's my hope, not just in Not Equal, but everything that we do through the Radiance Foundation.
Yeah. So can you talk to us a little bit more about what the mission, what the goals are of the Radiance Foundation? You guys, at least in your book, and I know in your presentations that I've heard, you cover kind of a large spectrum of movements and civil rights movements and issues. You've mentioned some of them already. Can you flesh that out for us for a little bit?
Sure. The Radiance Foundation was started in order to do three things: to illuminate, to educate, and to motivate. We want to illuminate the most basic truth that every human life has irreplaceable intrinsic value. And then we want to educate people about a myriad of social issues, all the easy topics, you know, the stuff that's so easy to engage in around the family table or, you know, in the workplace. So we talk about abortion, we talk about adoption, we talk about fatherlessness, Black Lives Matter movement, Planned Parenthood. We even talk about LGBT activism, judicial activism, the infringement on so many of our First Amendment rights. So we tackle these things, including, you know, free speech, religious liberty. And so these are some of the things that we try to educate a myriad of different audiences. So whether you're in a middle school or whether you're 70 plus, we've had such incredible audiences around the world to be able to educate and engage on these topics. And then we want to motivate people, which, you know, is the easiest thing in the world to do.
Of course. Apathy, not even an issue.
Not at all. I mean, you know, we should be the most informed generation ever, the most informed society ever, I should say, all generations combined. I mean, we have more access to data than ever before with our mobile devices and our computers. Yet, what good is all this information if we do nothing with it? And so the Radiance Foundation exists to motivate people to actually act in positive and peaceful ways to change not only things within themselves, but of course, things that affect their families, their communities. And, you know, these are no simple things to do. And we do this through four main things. And we do this through the creative ad campaigns that mm-hmm. we launch, whether billboard or social media. We do this through fearless journalism. We do a ton of research and a lot of writing. We do this through the multimedia presentations that we have been blessed to be able to present around the world, and then through some of our compassionate community outreaches, like our Sally's Lambs outreach, which is our initiative focusing on birth moms who choose adoption over abortion. They're in a really big nutshell.
Yeah.
What we are, we're passionate about God, which makes us passionate about people.
Yeah, that's great. Is this your first book that you've published?
This is the very first, Not Equal.
Awesome.
I thought I'd start it easy, you know.
Yeah. See, of course. Easy topic, you know, kind of ease into it. That's good. Yeah. What was your inspiration for writing Not Equal?
You know, when you think of human beings who aren't considered equal today, obviously there is a particular group, the unborn. And then even within the unborn, there is a fringe that is even less equal than those who are not equal.
Not equal. Mm-hmm.
That's those like me, who were conceived in violence, conceived in rape. And so for me, it's kind of the label, although maybe not necessarily spoken verbatim, but it's the label put on by pro-abortion activists that I'm even less human, have even less of a reason. And so I look at an industry, and I consider it this, the civil rights industry, and how far it's veered from the path of defending the most defenseless, of protecting the vulnerable and the disenfranchised, and it doesn't. I mean, the civil rights industry is in bed with, literally, with Planned Parenthood. And so, you know, that's why I had to call it Not Equal, Civil Rights Gone Wrong. I mean, when you have the leading civil rights organization like the NAACP, which has fought valiantly over the years for the dismantling of racism, of social policies, of Jim Crow social policies, you know, fought for Brown v. Board of Education. I revered them when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And yet today, they actively partner with the leading killer of unarmed black lives, of unarmed white lives, and unarmed lives of any color in between. And so I started doing research to find out how could this possibly be. And so it led to a lot of these articles, just kind of exposing who and what these civil rights groups are, and then led to Not Equal.
Wonderful. And you do have, I mean, in here, just looking through your table of contents, and I know from my reading, you cover a huge number of issues. And I love it because it responds, a lot of these respond to particular things. So things that have come out in the media, statements that people have made, that kind of thing. And it's direct responses to them. And like you mentioned, you do a ton of research. So there's what, five, seven, eight? No, there's a ton of pages. I'm flipping through them. There's like 20 pages in the back of footnotes and citations and documentations and end notes and where I found all this stuff. And here's the websites and here's the pages and all that kind of thing. Which is just fantastic. I love giving people information that's clearly backed up by facts. So I love that you have all of that at the back. What were some of your favorite topics to talk about in this book? I mean, of all the ones that you cover, what were the ones that tapped into your passion the most?
Well, of course, adoption does. You know, not just being an adoptee, but an adoptive father. Obviously, that's really close to my heart. And in this fight to defend human dignity, the topic of adoption doesn't come up nearly enough, but you can't talk about abortion without talking about adoption.
Right.
It's like not finishing a sentence. You know what I mean? That's exactly what it's like. And so that's why it's one of the first chapters in this book. You know, so that is really pivotal to me. And then, of course, just kind of giving a little historical perspective, because I think you have so many people today, so many liberal activists, pro-abortion activists, who just want to completely disregard history, because they have to. They have to dismantle or revise history because they can't boast about it. They can't actually talk about it because then it makes them face some very inconvenient truths. So that's why, for instance, when I talk about Martin Luther King, one of my chapters, Martin Luther King Jr. and the social injustice of abortion, today Planned Parenthood wants to boast. They use him. They invoke his name all the time. They use him to, you know, promote their main business, which is abortion. And they always talk about how, well, he received their Margaret Sanger Award, the first one. Well, yes, 1966, when abortion wasn't legal. Let's put things into context.
Yeah.
And yes, our civil rights leaders and our civil rights champions, even like Martin Luther King Jr., they weren't omniscient. Mm-hmm. And he certainly wasn't perfect. And at the time, he did praise Planned Parenthood because he believed, as many did at that time, that birth control actually would reduce poverty. It never did, and it still doesn't reduce poverty. So I love giving that historical perspective. So those are two of my favorite ones. And then, you know, quite often, the hang up the hangers.
Mm-hmm.
I love just one of the most common lies in the abortion industry, the whole, you know, hanging up the hangers. They practically worship these hangers. And yet, you know, you have Planned Parenthood debunked their own lie back during a conference in 1959 saying that the death rate was so low, only 260 women. Now, I'm not dismissing any death. Every single death is tragic.
Right.
But when you have Planned Parenthood saying 260 deaths is a low total number from abortions of any kind, and they say, well, abortionists must be doing a good job. Well, which is it? Were millions of women dying because of, you know, in self-inflicted abortions, or was it a non-issue? So, you know, just pointing out the total hypocrisy, the total historical revision that happens by not just Planned Parenthood, but mainstream media and civil rights groups. So there's a lot of things to expose, and you need more than, you know, 160 pages to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But this is just a start to illuminating some of these basic myths and just shredding them.
Yeah.
Just a few words, or at least trying to. That's That was my hope.
Right. Attempting to shred them. It's going to take a while, I think. And especially as they keep on putting out more things that we need to then go through and pull apart and tease out and take a look at. Right. The job is never really done. But this is a good start at it.
Yes. Yeah.
So if you're just joining us now, welcome to I Choose Life News and Views. I'm speaking with Ryan Bomberger today, who's a co-founder of the Radiance Foundation, and then also the author of a new book called Not Equal, Civil Rights Gone Wrong. So he's on with us today talking about his book and just about the Radiance Foundation as well and what all they cover. And Ryan has a unique perspective on all this because of his history. Ryan, let's dig into just a few of these articles and give people kind of a taste of what you have in this book. First of all, if they want to find this book, Ryan, where can they find it?
The easiest place to go is notequalbook.com.
Oh, perfect. Very easy. Notequalbook.com. Okay. And we'll link that on our website as well for people to be able to find there. All right. So you start off, I love this book. It's fantastic. You start off the book, chapter one. The very first chapter is called, I Am Not the Rapist's Child. Can you tell us a little bit about that? It's a strong start.
Yes. I mean, I can't even go into this without giving a little background to who I am. And you see in that chapter the image there that says conceived in rape but adopted and loved. And it's mm-hmm. an image of my mom and the first moment she had to hold me at 6 weeks of age. And, you know, the whole issue of rape, it's the go-to all the time by pro-abortion activists. If they fail in trying to defend anything else, they will immediately go to what if the woman is raped? So the what if is actually played out all the time, although it's, you know, the what ifs comprise 1% of all abortions. That's not to demean or trivialize that experience, but there are so many women who actually choose life. They don't choose the further violence of abortion, and their stories are worth being heard. And so part of that, I talk about that in this chapter, of course, the courage of my birth mom to choose life. And I believe the percentage is about 40% of women who choose life instead of abortion, which people are always throwing as the natural follow-up.
Right.
And yet to see that 40%, nearly 40% choose life. And the reason for that, and behind, I think I include this in the article, but I get to meet a lot of women, a lot of people on the events that we get to speak at, and I meet rape survivors, and the common thread through their experience is that the child is the only redemptive part of such a horrific act. Even those who chose abortion agree and feel the same way. And so that's a really interesting thing. And of course, mainstream media doesn't ever talk about it because immediately you're branded the rapist child. And quite honestly, I was her child.
Right.
God's child. And the only reason why these pejoratives like rape baby and demon seed and rapist child are used is to dehumanize that innocent child who had nothing to do with the crime. And so I just try to present a different side of the story to those who either have experienced this horrific act or those who think that abortion is a natural and compassionate follow-up to rape.
Yeah, and that just absolutely blew me away in this chapter, is you saying how people actually call you those things, like rapist child and demon. I mean, that's unbelievable to me.
It is, and it's not just pro-abortion activists who use some of that wording. I mean, demon seed, I mean, that came from Sean Hannity. So it's just interesting, because even those who do embrace a pro-life ideology sometimes forget the innocence and the value of every human life, of that human life that was conceived in violence but is not defined by that violence.
And you mentioned how women who have survived rape have told you that having the child, and I think whether parented or not, is the only redemptive thing in that whole situation. Can you tease that out for us a little bit? What's their thinking behind that? Because one of the really common arguments, of course, is that the baby is a reminder of what happened. That's the one that we hear all the time. Well, they'll look at their face and they'll see their rapist. So can you tease out that redemptive piece for us a little bit? How does that actually work?
You know, I've heard this from a number of rape survivors. Rebecca Berg is one of them. And she's spoken on behalf of National Right to Life and Students for Life. Just an amazing testimony. Someone who had been raped in college and yet I'll never forget just hearing her share her story and just being, you know, as someone whose biological mother chose life, it just hits me even harder. But to hear her say, my son never reminds me of my rapist.
Mm.
He never reminds me. And then she went on to describe all the things that her son is to her. And so that is the reality. And it's understandable that someone thinks that is, but yet that's not the account that I hear from rape survivors who have chosen life, who have chosen to parent that child. And so this is the kind of substance I wish, you know, the kind of dialogue I wish existed in mainstream media, but they don't. They don't want to hear from the Rebecca Bergs. They don't want to hear from those who were conceived in rape and to see who they've become. Because often we're told we will be just like the rapist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the rapist, the one that they don't ever want to punish, by the way.
Right.
That's the part of the conversation. Like, let's talk about punishing the guy who actually inflicted this horrific harm on the woman. Oh, no, no. Let's not talk about that. Let's talk about immediately, let's destroy that human life.
Well, and especially recently, we've had this college swimmer who has just went through his court cases for having raped a woman and is getting off, I mean, with a ridiculously light sentence that has just swept through our news recently. And you're right, people are, of course, outraged, and rightly so, that he is getting off so lightly. And the judge said, well, we don't want to ruin his college experience. Like, excuse me?
Sorry to mess up his little, fun
during
his collegiate days, but it is despicable. It's despicable often how, I mean, is it any wonder that we have a rape culture when, you know, so, what was the other case? The case where the father said, you know, why should the rest of his life be ruined for?
Right, that's exactly it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, same one. He's got all these swimming medals. You know, he's a great swimmer. What? He's a great swimmer, but he made a horrible decision.
Yeah, 15 minutes of his life. I'm sorry, if it was 1.5 seconds of his life, if he did something horrific and violent to somebody, those are the consequences.
Right.
It doesn't even matter what the rest of his life was comprised of. He violated and took something away from someone that can never be regained.
And instead of focusing on that, we have the focus on, she won't be able to handle looking at that baby.
You know, and it's amazing, because women, you know, because you are one, women are the most resilient, resourceful beings on this planet.
We're phenomenal.
Yes, I will say that. And you'll be married to an amazing, amazing woman. Women overcome all the time. My wife was a single mom for a year. She felt all this pressure from her colleagues. She was a teacher, to abort our daughter, our oldest daughter, Haley Radiance. I mean, it's unbelievable. When you cheapen the ability of women by saying, you know what, just give up, give in, you can't overcome this. Here's abortion. By the way, it'll profit us, but it won't profit you at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's just disgusting, because people, men and women, overcome the seemingly impossible all the time. Yet abortion is just thrown out there because it says, you know what, you're too weak as a woman. There's no way that you can rise above this. Yes, you can.
Yeah. And so we have that sort of perspective of women coming from the liberal media, which is so interesting because they pair themselves with feminism and say, oh, no, we want women. We want the best for women. We want them to be empowered. And yet they have this sort of backhanded, but you can't deal with this kind of thing going on. Let's switch over real fast and talk about fatherlessness. We have just a couple minutes left, but fatherlessness is something I feel like isn't addressed much. And you address it in your book. And so can you touch on that for us?
As a dad, I love talking about this. It breaks my heart to see a nation that has an epidemic of fatherlessness, yet it pretends that it doesn't exist at all. I mean, we want to talk about Zika virus, and anytime some sort of flu comes in, and we want to talk about those things, how it impacts our culture, yet the existence of this epidemic where almost 42% of America's children are born into homes without fathers, and in the Black community, it's so much higher, 72.3%. How do we not talk about this? And here again, the nation's civil rights organizations, for the longest time, up until last year, the NAACP wouldn't even address the issue of fatherlessness at all. In fact, you put in fatherlessness in a Google search and you would get NAACP membership, sign up your dad for a member. Well, when dads are missing, are hugely MIA in the Black community, I don't think they're really going to be wanting an NAACP membership.
What?
So it's crazy. So I talk about this. I talk about the impact of fathers not being in the home, the deterioration of two-parent married families with a mother and a father, the best environment for any child to grow up in. And I realize that there's single parents who do all they can to raise their children. But as I say in this chapter, mothers were never meant to play the role of both mother and father. And so I address this because it's impossible to talk about the whole abortion movement and not talk about what it promotes. And that is, it promotes the deterioration of family, because when you take the father out of the family, you leave a vulnerable family. When you have a vulnerable family, you have vulnerable communities. And they are the best community for the predators known as the abortion clinics and abortion mills and Planned Parenthood. That's how they are able to more easily prey on these communities. And that's why you see them in these communities, 79% of them located like Planned Parenthood abortion centers, predominantly located in Black and Hispanic neighborhoods, all within walking distance. And so there's a reason for that. There's a reason why they don't celebrate marriage, or at least I should say heterosexual marriage. They don't at all. Planned Parenthood only celebrates one form of marriage, and that's gay marriage. They do not celebrate the intact marriage of man and woman, because they understand that that existence repels their existence.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I talk about dads matter in this, I mean, I had an amazing father as a role model. I love him like crazy. His sacrifice, I mean, there's the sacrifice of men and women, of mothers and fathers, the self-sacrifice, that is what makes all this so much different. Because the abortion industry says sacrifice, yes, sacrifice others. But as a father, and my wife as the mother, we self-sacrifice all the time for our children. That's the way it should be. That's the way humanity should be. We are at our best when we sacrifice ourselves in order to elevate somebody else.
Well, Ryan, thank you so much for joining us, and especially going out on that note. That's such a fantastic thing to remember. And I've heard it said lots of times that when you get married, you learn to be more selfless because now you're married to someone. And then you sort of can sit there and become sort of a selfish couple together. And then you have children and they pull you back out of that selfishness again. So thank you so much for joining us, for sharing with us your experiences, your insight, and then also this new book. Of course, I would encourage you guys to check it out. Not Equal, Civil Rights Gone Wrong. We'll have a link up to it at ichooselife.org, but then also notequalbook.com. Thank you so much, Ryan.
Thank you, Abigail.
You've been listening to I Choose Life News and Views. If you have questions about this program or if you'd like to support the fight for life, please call 260-471-1849 or go to ichooselife.org, because without the right to life, no other rights matter.